The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. And let me call the case. It's number, the first argued case this morning is number 2207, Custom Play LLC against Amazon.com Incorporated. All right, Mr. Carey, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor, and good morning to you and to the court, and may it please the court. I'm John Carey, and I represent the appellant Custom Play LLC, which is a Florida-based technology company that has developed software programs and other applications designed to allow viewers of videos to customize their video watching experience and interact in real time with the video as they view it. Custom Play has a variety of different applications that do these things, and it has obtained a number of patents for its technology, including the patent that is at issue in this case.
Counsel, you raised some constitutional issues in your brief. Are you still going to argue those this morning?
Some of them, Your Honor, yes, we are maintaining. One of them we indicated in a prior filing that we were not maintaining, but there are others that are still at issue and are part of the appeal.
Okay, just to be sure for the record, which is the argument you're no longer pursuing?
We after the Supreme Court issued its Arthrex decision last year, in response to an order from the court to advise how the parties in the case thought Arthrex impacted this appeal, we made a filing and indicated that in view of the Supreme Court's Arthrex decision, we were withdrawing our appointments clause challenge that we had presented.
Okay, let's start with a constitutional issue, so that because we realize this issue is common to the three cases being argued, and we'll adjust the timing so that we don't run out of time on the merits.
Okay, Your Honor, that sounds great. The constitutional issues that
aren't the constitutional issues that you're raising now foreclosed by our decisions in Ethicon and Mobility Works? Isn't the panel bound by those?
We're asking the panel to reconsider those decisions. Those authorities do rule the other way from the position that we're advancing. We're asking.
What do you mean by reconsider? You're seeking that we rule those decisions?
Yes, we're contending that the constitutional law issues that were decided in those decisions were incorrectly decided, and we're asking this panel to revisit those. And one of the reasons that we're asking the court to revisit those is there have been, at least with respect to Ethicon, there was an intervening Supreme Court decision in the SAS case, which
I think we can consider your arguments if you're seeking to differentiate those cases from yours or trying to distinguish them. But we can't overrule this court's precedent.
Well, Your Honor, you can consider the precedent in light of the Supreme Court's guidance in SAS, which postdated Ethicon, and which was not in the argument that we're making about SAS was not considered, as far as we can tell, in the Mobility Works matter. You know, in SAS, the Supreme Court interpreted the same statute here, the America Invents Act, and forcefully concluded that the actual text of the statute controls and must be followed as written. And so in that case, as I'm sure the court's aware, where the statute used the phrase, you know, any claim challenged, Supreme Court concluded that any claim challenged meant any claim challenged and not, as the agency had been interpreting it, you know, at least one claim challenged. And here—
So what does that have to do? This relates to the issue resolved by Ethicon, right? And you're saying how Ethicon is no longer good law after SAS. Why is that?
Well, as I'm attempting to explain, Your Honor, SAS made clear that this statute is supposed to be that the clear terms of the statute are supposed to be given full legal force and effect and are not to be interpreted in any other way. And the statute says that the director is the only, the director must be the person to decide whether an IPR is instituted. And the statute sets up a very specific scheme for director institution and then review and final decision by the board. And the agency has conflated those roles improperly in violation of the text of the statute, as well as impinged on the constitutional rights. So there's two prongs to the to the.
Well, what does SAS have to do with the Constitution?
SAS has to do with the statutory interpretation issue, Your Honor.
But not the constitutional issue.
Not directly the constitutional issue, right?
Okay, so Ethicon is binding on us as to the constitutional issue.
Well, Ethicon, I don't. Ethicon dealt with the prejudgment bias issue, it did not. I don't recall that it dealt with the financial incentive issue that we're raising. That issue.
Well, that's mobility.
That was.
I think what we're trying to understand is what arguments do you have that aren't foreclosed by Ethicon and mobility work? So far, I'm only hearing that this so-called statutory issue in with respect to the same panel doing institution and the merits. The statutory issue has been changed by SAS, but I don't hear that the constitutional rulings of Ethicon and mobility works are affected by any intervening authority, correct?
Not intervening authority, but we have different arguments regarding those that were not presented in Ethicon, and we think the court should allow us to make to present our argument on that, and if it should it find our arguments persuasive, then it could reach a different resolution. For example, if I may, one of the rationales articulated in Ethicon for the conclusion that there was no due process violation with respect to a prejudgment bias from having the board decide institution and also the merits of the final written decision. There was an analogy that Your Honor made in authoring Ethicon to preliminary injunctions in district court. And that was one of the reasons that the court, didn't really didn't find that the prejudgment bias issue presented a constitutional problem. But we look at that, we have some additional argument on that particular comparison. An IPR is very different than a district court infringement suit. A judge decides a preliminary injunction, but usually a jury decides the trial. And so that analogy really doesn't hold water. Where here the board decides, the same board consisting of the exact same board members decides the institution and the final written decision. So the prejudgment bias problem is much more acute here than it is in the district court setting. And so that analogy to the district court setting that was part of the reasons that this argument was rejected in Ethicon ought to be reconsidered. That analogy and another big difference between another reason that analogy doesn't work is the nature of the two proceedings are so vastly different. I mean, in an IPR, for example.
Counselor, you seem to be arguing that Ethicon is bad law. Is that correct?
The argument that I'm making right now, I think it was wrongly decided, yes. I'm making arguments that weren't even made in Ethicon. This court is free to look at precedents in a new light based upon new arguments. Otherwise, we would never have, the law would never develop. And so there's nothing wrong with that. The analogy that, again, I want to make this point about.
You're just arguing that an analogy that was used in Ethicon isn't an apt analogy. It doesn't seem to me to be a new argument.
Well, I mean, that analogy was one of the main reasons that the prejudgment bias issue was not found in Ethicon to present a constitutional infirmity. And if the analogy doesn't, if the analogy is inapt, then I think that the reasoning, Ethicon's reasoning should be reconsidered.
How do you distinguish your case, this case, from Ethicon? And we're going to follow this court's precedent, and this panel cannot overrule prior precedent. So it would be well to hear the argument from you as to why the Ethicon case does not apply. What's different about your situation than from Ethicon?
Right, and Your Honor, I was trying to make this point about this district court analogy that was relied upon in Ethicon for its holding on the Constitution.
So that argument was already heard in Ethicon. You're repeating an argument that was made in Ethicon.
But I have a twist on that argument, a new way to look at that argument, and I don't believe that my point was considered in that case. So I made one point about the decision makers being very different in a preliminary in court. You've got a judge who decides a preliminary injunction, but normally a jury that decides the trial. And so you have different decision makers, unlike here in the IPRs.
Juries don't decide injunction cases.
They decide the facts in injunction cases.
They do not. The court decides the facts in injunction cases.
The court can present the issues of fact, and then and of course fashion injunctive relief as here she deemed appropriate. Correct. That's true.
That's all right. To move on, I think as counsel knows, and to remind my colleagues, I dissented in Ethicon. It seems clear to me that the issues need a fresh look. Whether it can be corrected by a panel or by this court in bank or by an act of Congress, and I must say I had pretty much come to conclude that this was going to require legislative adjustment, or at least perhaps a fresh look by a new director. But to me, these are very important live issues. But at the same time, counsel, as far as this panel is concerned, of course, it is true we are bound by our precedent unless we find a way of bringing that precedent before the full court for review, which is a project. And so let's move on to the merits, to the substance of our arguments. And I know that this is the issue on which the office requested to intervene, but at the same time, let's set the intervener's response into where it is on the agenda. And let's then start afresh with the merits of this appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. So in this first case, this case involves the 346 patent. And as far as the grounds of unpatentability were just obviousness grounds. There were, it's important to keep in mind that there was no anticipation found in this matter, or in the other matters, by the way. But the rejections that the board issued are premised on one of two pieces of art in this 346 patent IPR. And we're on appeal. We contested many of these things in the IPR itself, but due to space considerations, et cetera, we've narrowed the issues that we presented on the appeal to a couple of limitations that we contend were not disclosed in the prior art references that the board relied on. And of course, if for obviousness purposes, the references have to disclose each element, each limitation of the claimed invention in order for there to be a prima facie case of obviousness. And for this case,
Are you arguing that a single reference must disclose all the limitations in order to find obviousness?
Your Honor, that's not what I meant.
All right.
That would be anticipation. What I'm saying is that the combination of references, for obviousness, the combination of references have to include all the limitations.
Well, you've got a problem here. As I understand it, you're really only addressing claim 13 here in this first IPR. Is that correct?
13 and 20, Your Honor.
You've got multiple rejections here that you have to overcome, right?
Well, really, we have two rejections that we have to overcome, because the decisions on claims 13 and 20 rely on Thomas for one of the limitations, and Clark. So if we are right that neither Thomas nor Clark disclose these limitations, then the prior art that the board relied on did not show all the limitations in the claim, and so its decision should be reversed. And so the first,
I thought only ground 4 relied on Clark.
That's right. Only ground 4 relied on Clark. The other grounds all relied on Thomas for the limitation concerning the continuously identifying a location in the video. So that limitation the board relied on Clark. I'm sorry. Not Clark. The board relied on Thomas for that limitation in all the other grounds except for the Clark ground.
I thought in ground 2 they relied on McIntyre.
Not for the continuously identifying a current location in the video, they relied on Thomas and McIntyre. They did not rely on McIntyre for the related limitation of continuously identifying the name of a performer associated with the location. That was just Thomas.
Doesn't Thomas describe two different systems, a synchronous system and an asynchronous metadata, and that the asynchronous metadata system discloses the limitation that you're talking about, continuously identifying the location?
So, Your Honor, Thomas discloses a synchronous metadata system where all the data is coded up front about where the performers are, where they appear in the movie, and then that metadata file is sent with the video itself. And so because it's a synchronous, what the synchronous means there is that the data has already been synchronized. In other words, where the actor appears in the movie is already specified in the synchronous metadata, and it's already been synchronized to every location in the movie where the actor appears. So because Thomas applies this synchronized metadata file where all of these locations in the video have already been predetermined of where the actor appears, it's a different architecture, if you will, than the 346 patented system, which doesn't do it that way. It does it a different way. Both patents have a common goal of figuring out, who's that person I just saw in the movie. They both seek to do that, but they do it in very different ways. And that's fine. You can patent different ways of doing the same thing. That happens all the time, right? So the architecture of the 346 patent is a real-time video system, and the 346 patent requires a continuous monitoring of the video as it's being played to the viewer and identifying as it's being played the location in the video and whether a performer appears in the video at that location. The Thomas system doesn't need to do that and therefore does not do that because it has all of the data encoded up front in the synchronous metadata file. So it doesn't perform these steps of continuously identifying the location in the video or continuously identifying the performer that's associated with the identified location. It's just a conceptually different way of going about it. And that was the board's mistake in not recognizing that distinction. We also, so that's the principal issue there, Your Honor. And we had, you know, our expert made this point. There was no specific rebuttal to this point, and the board appears to have just not, appears to have ignored this argument and did not refute it. The issue of the combination of Thomas and McIntyre, again, the
board made a finding, I think one of the central findings that it made, and I want to see, it said that in asynchronous system, the metadata is sent separately from the video and is linked to the relevant limit location. Seems to me that that discloses the limitation that you're talking about. Was the board wrong in that finding?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, what was the question?
Was the board wrong in that finding?
Are you referring to a finding relating to the Thomas reference?
Yes.
Yes, so Thomas did not disclose an asynchronous system. It disclosed a synchronous metadata file.
But they found that satisfied the claim limitation.
But what they found that, yes, but the thing, what we're saying is a synchronous system has no need to continuously identify a location because all the data is already synchronized, and therefore you don't need to monitor where you are as you play the video. The data is already pre-synchronized, and therefore it doesn't perform the step of continuously identifying during the playing of the video where you are in the video and identifying a performer that matches that location. That whole process in Thomas is done beforehand, before the video is ever played, before the user plays the video back, and the video has an accompanying metadata file, which identifies where the performers are located in the video. It's not done in real time during the playing of the video, is the point. And that's the distinction.
The information is available in real time while you're playing the video, right?
Well, the user, the system accesses the information, but the claim limitation is for identifying a location in a video, and the related limitation is identifying continuously identifying a location in a video and continuously identifying a performer associated with that location. That the continuous identification process is not performed using a synchronized metadata file because there was the identification process is already run. It's already existing in the data.
But Thomas performs that function, right?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, it does not. Thomas doesn't perform the function because it already has in the synchronized data file, it's already matched up everywhere the performers appear in the video, and it doesn't identify the video, the location in the video as the video is playing, to then try to identify where the performer appears and then tell the viewer, you know, give them the name.
So does Thomas disclose asynchronous data?
It only discloses a synchronous metadata.
And the board found that it also discloses the use of asynchronous data, right? That's what the board found.
And there's no support in Thomas for that. There's only the synchronous metadata file.
So it's a substantial evidence question.
It is, Your Honor. But, you know, the evidence is lacking here.
Okay, if there are no more questions at the moment, let's hear from the other side and we'll save the full rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Heidemann.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to start with the constitutional issue. I think the panel has it correct. The arguments here are foreclosed by this court's prior decisions in Ethicon and Mobility Works. And this panel is bound to follow those precedents. It sounds like Custom Plays Council is simply re-arguing the merits of those cases and apparently disagrees with one of the analogies used in Ethicon. But there's nothing new that has happened since. Those decisions certainly haven't been overruled by any intervening Supreme Court decision, And so Amazon would submit that this panel should follow those decisions and reject custom play statutory and due process violation arguments. Turning to the merits of, unless your honors would like to hear from the government on the constitutional issues, I can proceed straight to the merits.
Now we'll hear from the government after we finish the merits.
Okay, thank you, your honor. I want to correct one statement that Custom Plays Council made, and that is that the board did not rely on McIntyre in ground two for its disclosure of continuously identifying a current location in a video. In the final written decision on page 32, that's in the appendix of page 32, the board clearly finds that McIntyre discloses or renders this limitation obvious, even without Thomas. The board stated
that Thomas make that same disclosure.
Thomas also discloses that limitation, but for ground two, the board relied on McIntyre's disclosure and found that a skilled artisan would have found it obvious to identify a current location continuously based on McIntyre's teachings. And so when counsel for Custom Play argues that they only found that limitation disclosed in Clark and Thomas, that's incorrect. In ground two, the board clearly relied on McIntyre's disclosure of that limitation, and that finding was supported by substantial evidence. With respect to Thomas, the board found that Thomas identifies the current location in a video, and that's in the appendix at 9 to 10. And those findings, that finding is supported by substantial evidence, including numerous citations to different portions and disclosures in Thomas and to Amazon's expert testimony. And Custom Play never addresses the evidence that the board actually relied on. Instead, they're advancing an argument that Thomas is limited to synchronous metadata when it's clearly not. They rely on a single paragraph in Thomas, paragraph 44, and argue that Thomas only discloses the use of synchronous metadata. The board correctly rejected that argument in the appendix at pages 10 to 11. And as the board noted, even the paragraph that Custom Play relies on, that's paragraph 44, states that the use of synchronous metadata is only an example. The board then went on and referred to paragraph 123 of Thomas. Paragraph 123 of Thomas discloses an alternate approach. And so paragraph 122 of Thomas discloses the synchronous metadata approach. Paragraph 123 of Thomas discloses an alternate approach that does not use synchronous metadata and instead teaches that the content is sent separately from or prior to the media or the video that it's going to be used with. That paragraph of Thomas is describing figure 22 of Thomas, which is in the appendix at page 1209. And figure 22 of Thomas clearly discloses synchronous metadata on the one hand, if the metadata is sent with the video, and then a different approach where that metadata can be sent prior to and separately from the video using any number of other approaches. In rejecting Custom Play's argument that Thomas is limited to synchronous metadata, the board cited Amazon's expert and found his testimony credible and persuasive. And essentially what Custom Play is doing is ignoring all of the rest of Thomas and claiming that paragraph 44 shows that it only discloses synchronous metadata when that paragraph does not even support that proposition. And so Custom Play is here arguing that the board's decision lacks substantial evidence when it doesn't even address the evidence that the board relied on. There are many other disclosures in Thomas besides paragraph 44, and those disclosures clearly show the use of non-synchronous or asynchronous metadata. Just going back to McIntyre for a second on the merits of it, McIntyre disclosed identifying the current location in the video using what they call the segment identifier. And again, the board reached that conclusion in the appendix in 32 that McIntyre discloses that limitation. In doing so, the board cited both McIntyre's disclosure and Custom Play's own expert, and that's in the appendix at page 26. And again, Custom Play never addresses that evidence and never addresses the fact that McIntyre clearly discloses identifying the location using a segment identifier, and that segment identifier can be, for example, a frame number. So unless the panel has specific questions about McIntyre or Thomas, I will cede the rest of my time to the court or to the government.
Okay, any more questions for counsel? Okay, thank you. Well, all right, it's time for the intervener to have the last word on this side. Anything that you wish to ask from the viewpoint of the office?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, McKay Neumeister for the government. All the issues in this appeal on which the government intervened have either been withdrawn or resolved by squarely on-point circuit precedent. Custom Play's statutory challenge to the delegation of institution decisions to the board was resolved in Ethicon. Its due process challenge to the same panel handling both institution and the merit stays was also resolved in Ethicon, as confirmed recently in Mobility Work. And the other due process challenge to the funding and compensation structure of the board was also resolved in Mobility Work. Finally, Custom Play withdrew its appointments clause challenge in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in Arthrex. Accordingly, binding precedent controls all the live issues that the government addresses in this case, but I'm happy to answer any questions the court may have.
Any questions for counsel? Okay, thank you. We understand the issues. Let's turn to rebuttal in that case. Mr. Carey, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. So briefly, regarding Thomas and McIntyre on the issue of the continuous identification issue. The argument
But opposing counsel is correct that there's an independent ground resting on McIntyre, which doesn't rest on Thomas, right?
McIntyre was relied on for the continuously identifying the location issue. That is an alternative ground for that limitation, but not for the continuous identification of the performer name associated with the location. That was just Thomas. That's what I believe I said in my opening remarks. Counsel said that I wasn't right about that, but there's a distinction between how McIntyre and Thomas were used. Thomas and McIntyre were used for the continuous identification of the location. Thomas alone was used for the continuous identification of the performer associated with the location. So let me get to the substance of.
I thought ground two didn't rely on Thomas. Am I mistaken? Could you show me where it does rely on Thomas?
So, Your Honor, if you look at. Let's see here. For claims 13 and 20,
okay.
Well, if you look at the holding page of the final written decision, which is Appendix 57,
okay.
So for claims 13 and 20, and again, we're on appeal. We limited the appeal to claims 13 and 20, right? So claims 13 and 20 rely on both McIntyre and Thomas. And the other grounds that addressed claims 13 and 20 relied on Thomas or McIntyre. So there was no ground for the finding as to claims 13 and 20 based solely on McIntyre.
But the finding of a combination of Thomas and McIntyre, that's an alternative finding as to the patentability of claims 13 and 20, right?
It's alternative, Your Honor, with respect to the limitation of the continuous identification of the location of the video.
Right, and that's your argument. That's the limitation you're arguing for 13 and 20.
Well, that's one of the limitations we're arguing. We also argue the limitation, and this is, I can give you the page in our brief, Your Honor, but we also argue the limitation continuously identifying the name of a performer associated with the identified location. If you'd like to, I can.
That's okay.
Okay. So the getting to the substance of the synchronous metadata issue, you know, counsel for Amazon says, well, the board also found that Thomas has asynchronous data and is not just synchronous data. By the way, there's a concession there that we're right about the synchronous metadata not satisfying the claim language. Okay. It's only because they're saying that Thomas has this other disclosure about asynchronous metadata that allows Thomas to be used here for either one of these limitations. And the problem.
But what's wrong with the board's finding that Thomas discloses the use of asynchronous data?
Right, and we address that, Your Honor. We address that in our brief and our reply brief. The quotation that they're pointing to there is a statement in Thomas where the metadata says it could be sent.
What page of the appendix are you talking about?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm gonna have to find that. Okay, that's appendix 1212.
Okay.
So what's being argued here is that there's a passage in Thomas where the metadata can be sent prior to or separate from the video itself. And they're concluding that changes Thomas from being the data from being synchronous and makes it asynchronous. Okay, but that's a wrong conclusion, because the issue isn't when the data is sent. Okay, it doesn't matter that it was sent prior to or separate from sending with the video. The point is that the data has been synchronized. The actor locations have been synchronized in the data to locations in the video. So whether or not the metadata is sent before the video is sent, with the video, or separate from the video, doesn't make it asynchronous. It's still synchronous data, because the data is already synchronized, that the actor data is synchronized to the location data. And the argument that Thomas has this alternative asynchronous disclosure is based upon this reference to, well, the data sent prior to or separate from, therefore it's asynchronous. That's factually wrong, because it's not when the metadata is sent that makes it synchronous or asynchronous. The fact that it's synchronized, the data is synchronized with the movie you're watching, that's what makes it synchronous. And so that argument is not supported by evidence, because it simply mischaracterizes what synchronized data is. All right. The other argument was about McIntyre being an alternative ground here. And again, if I wasn't clear in my opening comments, I'll try to clarify it now. So there's two limitations here. There's continuously identifying the location, and there's continuously identifying the name of a performer associated with the location. Thomas was used for both by the board. McIntyre was used for the first one, but not the second one. And by the way, the reason the board got it wrong about McIntyre, the reference there to McIntyre, you heard the discussion of the segment identifiers. So the finding that McIntyre disclosed continuously identifying a location in the video was based upon the segment identifier discussion of McIntyre. And as we argue in our briefs, that's also an asynchronous method of identifying the location. I'm sorry, a synchronous method of identifying the location, not an asynchronous method of identifying the location. That's also a synchronous method, and therefore McIntyre is no good as an alternative reference because it suffers from the same problem that Thomas does, i.e. it's a synchronous system, and it doesn't need to and does not perform the continuous identification step. But McIntyre was not used for that second limitation. It was just used for that first limitation. On the second limitation of identifying the performer, that's just Thomas.
Okay. Any more questions for Mr. Carey at this point? Okay. I think that we have the issues on this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. So this case is taken under submission.